Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Are you sick of the neocons and the Israel lobby pretending as though they've earned some kind of monopoly on foreign policy wisdom in Washington, D.C.? These peanut clowns who've never been right about anything? Well, the Council for the National Interest is pushing back and telling the lobby to go take a hike. The empire's bad enough without the neocons making it all about the interests of a foreign state. Help CNI promote peace. Visit their site at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click donate under About Us at the top of the page. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest on the show today is Kara Dansky from the ACLU. And she's helped with this new report, War Comes Home, The Excessive Militarization of American Policing. Welcome to the show, Kara. How are you doing?
Hi, good. Thanks for having me.
Good. Very happy to hear that, and very happy to have you here. Appreciate you joining us today. And appreciate this work. It's such important work. And like I always tell the people, and I learned this lesson, I guess, watching 2020 when I was a kid, that, wow, so if these lawyers don't show up at work at their nonprofit and sue the government all day, it doesn't get sued. If the ACLU does not demand accountability, there is no accountability in the American system. That's basically the way it is. And that's not just the ACLU. There are other groups like you, of course, that pursue the same sort of work. But, you know, this kind of thing is so important to, you know, preserving freedom in America, what we have left of it at this point anyway. And so thank you so much for doing it and helping draw attention to this. And I even think that maybe this is actually going to do some good, and that maybe this is really just a drop in that wave of real pushback against this as it becomes more of kind of common knowledge among everyone, not just sort of in fringe political opinion, but among all American society, that this militarization of our local deputy sheriffs has just gotten completely out of control here. So enough of my rant and raving. That's just a big extended thank you is all, really. Before we get to the beginning about the military training and the turning of the cops into the soldiers, I was hoping that you could start with sort of the second section here. Obviously ties into how the study was actually done, what information you were able to get, and what police agencies even had any information to give you, to what degree they were willing to cooperate, to let you know about what it was that they were up to, and all that kind of thing. If you could get that out of the way for us, please.
Absolutely. And, you know, I appreciate you having me on, and I appreciate your calling attention to this. And it's a really important point that you raise in terms of what is known and what is not known about this problem. You know, transparency is a real issue here, and data on the militarization of policing is very difficult to come by. We went directly to local law enforcement agencies. We didn't submit record requests to DOD or DHS or DOJ or any of the state agencies. We went directly to local law enforcement, and we asked them to give us records of all of their SWAT deployments for a two-year period of time. We were looking at 2011 and 2012. And we also asked them to send us records of equipment that they may have gotten from DOD during that time period, or money that they may have gotten from the Department of Justice or Homeland Security that they used to buy military equipment. So we asked for a lot of information, and to, you know, to answer your question directly, they were all over the map in terms of how they responded. Some law enforcement agencies turned over a lot of information. Some gave us none. And other agencies were at different points along the spectrum. Part of what makes analysis of this issue so difficult is that law enforcement agencies really vary a lot in terms of how they keep records of their SWAT deployments. Some keep a lot of information. Some don't keep very much information at all. So we did our analysis based on the information that we had available. But one of our biggest concerns is that there's not a lot of information available, and we're really hoping that will change.
Yeah. All right. Now, another thing here is something that was highlighted by Radley Balco at the Washington Post about this Massachusetts, I don't know exactly what they call it, but some kind of multi-jurisdictional task force that they've put together here, that they refused to answer any kind of open records request on the grounds that they're a private company and not actually a public police agency at all. And I guess, first of all, did I even really say that right at all? But then secondly, what exactly does that mean? Is that just a trick of paperwork in order to avoid public records? Or is this actually a new creature, more of a Blackwater type of a situation under local and state law enforcement in Massachusetts?
You know, my friends at the ACLU of Massachusetts, as you probably know, are filing suit to challenge that very situation. I think that you said it correctly, that the multi-jurisdictional task forces are claiming exemption from public records law on the basis that they're a private company. You know, I wish I had my colleagues from the ACLU of Massachusetts here with me so that they could get into some more details of that situation. They're much more up on it than I am, but that does seem to be the situation, but at the same time, even though they are claiming an exemption as a private company, we also know that they get money from the Department of Homeland Security through Homeland Security's Homeland Security Grant Program, which certainly seems to suggest that at least on some level they think of themselves as a public law enforcement agency. But so we'll see. You know, we'll have to see how that turns out. But the ACLU of Massachusetts could definitely tell you a lot more about that.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see if we can get Cade Crawford on the show next week.
That'd be great.
She's my lady there. All right. Okay, so now I guess if we could just sort of work through the table of contents here a little bit, and you know, if we could start out with the, well, I don't know, the military training. It's not so much the way that they fight, and, you know, I know they go to Fort Hood or Fort Bliss or whatever, and they do their military training, that kind of thing. But what I'm interested in, if you could tell me about what they're taught, what they are led to believe about the people that they're out enforcing the law against. Because at least the theory as I learned it in, you know, I don't know, high school or junior college or whatever, or watching Matlock, is the cop's job is to protect the rights of the suspects, right? The guy with the bloody hands is the guy who their job is making sure that nothing bad happens to him before he gets his fair trial, more than anything, right? That's the deal. And then just because he's accused doesn't mean he did it, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, it sounds like we're not even all suspects, which would be bad enough, but we're considered the enemy. We are like the fighting age males of Fallujah. We may or may not have just planted an IED against these guys, and we're all guilty as hell before proven innocent, it seems like, now.
Well, one of the things that we found when we analyzed 800 incident reports of SWAT deployments was that the vast majority were for the purpose of serving search warrants in people's homes. And to get to your point, you know, I think we need to understand that when there's a search warrant to search a person's home, there, you know, some judge, or not even always a judge, sometimes a magistrate or other public official, has determined that there's probable cause to think that drugs are in the home. That's basically all that's going on there. There have been no charges filed. There certainly have not been any convictions entered. So a service of a search warrant is basically a domestic criminal investigation, but there's been no finding that there's been any wrongdoing. So to use a paramilitary squad to serve a search warrant on a person's home for often a small amount of drugs seems to us as extremely problematic, especially given the often tragic results that can happen. But in terms of the training, we were given some documents by some of the agencies that responded to our request that really did seem to suggest that officers are being trained to think of themselves as warriors. Some of the training documents that we received taught police officers to, quote-unquote, steal your battle mind when you go into the field. And it really does seem like there's an effort to make the police think of themselves as soldiers fighting a war and the people that they're policing as the enemy. You know, we consulted with law enforcement during the course of this investigation because we are ourselves not, you know, we're not police officers. We're not necessarily law enforcement experts. And so we consulted with law enforcement and we spoke to a number of police officers who said that this is absolutely true. It's a cultural problem. Policing has become much more militarized, which really erodes public confidence in law enforcement. So we definitely think that there's an issue here in terms of training, in terms of training police officers specifically to think of themselves as soldiers.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, there's the music's already playing. We're going to have to go out and take this short break, Kara. But I hope you'll stay with us, and we'll do one more segment here on this new report from the ACLU on the militarization of the police. War Comes Home. We'll be right back in a sec. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Kara Dansky from the ACLU. And this report, terrifying new report that you already knew, but with details. War Comes Home, about the militarization of the police. And to make it a little bit interesting here, Kara, I'm going to try to pick a little bit of a controversy with you, which is that the ACLU has got to get good on guns. Because, as you know, half the population of America is armed. And in a society where all of our deputy sheriffs and city police are trained to be, you know, the wannabe 82nd Airborne looking for somebody to kill, and anybody even owning a gun increases their point system on the threat matrix up to the level of sending the Waco killers, this is leading to catastrophe all over the place. And, of course, you want to talk about race and dishonest application of the law. Forget the pot laws. Look at the gun laws. It's just insane that we have a situation. You know, it's like alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. All of them are legal, and yet we have an entire federal police agency armed to the teeth out there persecuting people for, you know, gun charges, which means they hadn't done anything. They just have a gun that the government says is contraband, which is the just like having drugs that the government says is contraband. Just like someone selling drugs or selling a gun to someone who wants to buy drugs or buy a gun. There's no crime involved other than the government said no. And then it becomes, because a gun is so scary, it becomes then the excuse for, hey, well, the rumor is these people have guns. There was one where the guy had a gun and he had been cited publicly saying the word Constitution before. So that meant he was a political zealot, and that gave him another 3 points on the threat matrix. So they came and with the armored personnel carrier to his family house, right? So anyway, get good on guns, because isn't that a huge part of this? The cops' attitude towards gun ownership by American civilians who, after all, have the right to bear arms.
You know, a couple of points about that. One thing is that when we were reviewing the 800 SWAT deployments that we analyzed, we did not come across, I don't think, a single time when the police distinguished between lawfully owned firearms and unlawfully possessed firearms when determining whether to deploy a SWAT team.
Mm-hmm.
So there didn't appear to me to be any effort on the part of the police to determine whether, if they were going to consider the fact that a person may have had a firearm in their home, whether that firearm was lawfully owned or not. Another thing I would just say is, you know, part of what happens here when they deploy a SWAT team, they often do so in the middle of the night, and they do so using tactics that are absolutely terrifying for the people who are subjected to them. And there have been a number of scenarios in which a person's family is at home sleeping in the middle of the night, as you'd expect. The family owns a firearm, which they're entitled to do in the state where they live. I know one case like this that happened in Texas and one that happened in Utah. And the police did a SWAT raid in the middle of the night, came into the home, and they thought that they were being burglarized. And they used their firearm, and actually police officers have died in this way. You know, police officers have been killed when people believe that they were being burglarized and were acting to defend their home. So I think that this is something that we really need to shine a light on. And getting back to my earlier point, there's been almost no transparency or oversight into the militarization of policing, and I think we need to really be better about that.
Right. Well, and you know, there's got to be some kind of checks and balances, and I'm not really one to just leave it up to, you know, a police hunch to decide necessarily. But then again, outsourcing decision making to something called a matrix, which is like some kind of magical abacus that knows how dangerous people are better. You know, it's like calling a polygraph a lie detector. It puts all this like truth and knowledge and judgment on something that can't possibly have any, right? It's the threat matrix, and the matrix has decided that this is the way we need to do it. It's almost like, you know, zero tolerance in government school where the valedictorian gets expelled over the butter knife or something, because it's just the what the computer screen says overrides any kind of knowledge. Like, hey, are we sure this house doesn't have kids in it or whatever? Is that part of the computer program? You know, how sure are we there are no kids present before we kick in this door? That kind of thing. This is a question a squad leader might wonder, but a computer might not when it's doing its calculation, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the threat matrix is interesting because in theory, it's supposed to bring some objectivity.
Right.
To the decision to use SWAT, which you know, could be a good thing. But the problem is that when they check off the boxes in the threat matrix, it still doesn't give you any insight into why they thought what they thought. So, for example, many of the threat matrices that they use will have a checkbox for drugs, a checkbox for, as you were saying earlier, guns. So if they check, you know, drugs and guns, that, you know, that weighs in favor often of deploying a SWAT team to serve a search warrant, but it doesn't tell you anything about why they thought that. It doesn't give any substantiation to the officer's belief that there are drugs present or that there are guns present. Those are just two examples. We came across a threat matrix that was in use in a town in North Carolina that used a person's religious views as a factor in deciding whether to deploy a SWAT team. So, you know, in some sense, having a threat matrix could bring some objectivity, which could be a good thing. But on the other hand, the threat matrices that we've seen don't seem to help the situation because they don't provide any insight into the underlying factors that the police are considering.
Right. Yeah. You know, if you never read it, you'd enjoy this book by Neil Postman called Technopoly. He's the guy that wrote Amusing Ourselves to Death and all that. But he talks about how all this technology changes what we even mean by knowledge and what we mean by decision making, and how so much of it has to do with outsourcing our decision making to, like you're saying, supposedly objective machines, that really it's just a matter of garbage in, garbage out, right? It doesn't say, even if the guy owns guns, is that because he's an 80-year-old hunter and he's from around here and all the cops and all the old cops know him and he's a good old boy? Or is it because we think that maybe he's smuggling Mexican immigrants and is armed to the teeth with him and his crew with AK-47s or something, right? Like, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say, you know, what about what gun or how likely, how criminal the person they suspect is or how desperate they might be or anything like that. That's all the kind of question that can only come up in a soft human brain, not in a computer.
But, yeah, we did not see in the course of our investigation very many incidents where there was that kind of analysis that was being done. We just didn't see it. A few. I mean, there were a few cases where you could tell that somebody was doing some really good work to figure out whether they really needed a SWAT team. Yeah. But the majority of cases, we didn't see that kind of analysis being done.
And again, as you said at the beginning, we're talking about where super majorities of all of these raids are about just contraband, you know, black market trade in contraband and that kind of thing. No actual crimes being committed against anyone else at all. And now, can you tell me how many of these are actual bank robbery with hostages like on TV where they would justify this kind of thing? What percent is that?
We found that of the 800 SWAT deployments we studied, and I should also just back up and say 800 is a tiny sliver of the number of SWAT deployments that happen nationally every year. So this is really an attempt to shine a light on a problem that we think is much broader. But we were not able, you know, by any means. There are tens of thousands of law enforcement agencies. So we really examined a tiny sliver of what's happening across the country. So I just want to make that clear.
Sure.
But of the 800 that we studied, almost 80% were for the purpose of serving a search warrant. About 7% were for the purpose of dealing with some kind of emergency scenario, such as a hostage taking or a barricade or an active shooter. And then the rest were other kinds of situations. Some of them involved VIP protection, visiting dignitaries, things of that nature. But nearly 80% were for the purpose of serving a search warrant.
And then I guess because it goes along with the war on drugs, and I'm sorry we're so short on time now, but can you address race and how this is implemented against minority groups that have so much less political power?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen over and over again over the last several decades how the war on drugs unfairly impacts people of color, communities of color. We know that people use and sell drugs at roughly the same rates across race, and yet it's been people of color who have really been unfairly impacted by the war on drugs. And the use of paramilitary weapons and tactics appears to be no different. So of the 800 incidents that we studied, we tried to figure out who was being impacted by these SWAT raids. And so we reviewed the reports and we tried to get a sense of who was involved, who was in the home, you know, were their families involved, were their children involved, and we counted up all the people who were impacted by the SWAT raids that we studied, and we found that the majority were people of color. About 54% of the people impacted were people of color. Significantly, when you break that down further into the percentage of cases where the purpose of the SWAT raid was for a drug warrant, 61% of the people impacted were people of color.
All right. We got to go, all out of time. Thank you so much, Kara. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Kara Dansky from the ACLU. War Comes Home. Go read it. Send it to your congressman. Hey, all Scott Horton here. Don't you want a bust of Murray Rothbard for your desk at work? A Ludwig von Mises for your bookshelf at home? A Harry Brown, a Ron Paul as a gift for a friend? Check out these awesome busts of your libertarian heroes at myheroesthink.com. They come in 6 or 9 inch sizes and now in color, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf in my office, and I love it. Just click the banner ad in the right margin at scotthorton.org and enter promo code ScottHortonShow to save $5. That's myheroesthink.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're 1-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com.